Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health and North Florida TPO.
Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and this is First Coast Connect. Today, the clock is ticking with less than 3 weeks ahead of a planned city council vote on the Jag Stadium deal. We're joined by Jacksonville Mayor Donna Deegan to talk about the latest on those discussions and to take your calls and questions. Later in the program, how toxic stress hurts moms and their babies and what local groups are doing to reduce infant mortality. But first, we're joined as we are each month by Mayor Donna Deegan for our Ask the Mayor segment, and no doubt lots to talk about. I want to get to the topic that continues to dominate city business, and that's the stadium. But let's just start with what a publisher friend of mine used to call a head check. How's stuff going on the fourth floor?
Really well. I mean, I'm very excited about all of this coming together. We're having great conversations with our city council people now, trying to educate them about the different elements of the deal. And I feel like overall, there's a lot of positive vibrations around everything.
So the stadium had its first, I guess, public airing of the council yesterday, their workshop. Is this going a little more smoothly than you anticipated?
No, honestly, we put a great deal of work. I mean, we're talking about 10 months worth of work into honing this agreement. We put a lot of thought into every aspect of it. And so I think there, as I said from the very beginning, I think there was a great desire from our administration and from the Jaguars to get to a fair deal that worked well for the city, for the taxpayers, for the Jaguars, and for the community. And I think that everybody who's looking at that is saying, wow, this is everything that has been advertised. You're seeing a few questions around the edges, which, of course, is what we expected and is certainly understandable that council would want to understand everything. So what we're trying to do right now is just answer all of their questions so that, you know, when we get to the point where there's actually a vote, it goes well.
Specifically, though, I mean, you have had, you know, occasional a little bit of a rocky road sometimes with the current city council president in terms of, you know, disagreements about procedure. He seems to be not only generally supportive, but really kind of eager to get this deal done on his watch. I mean, the timetable he's set is before his term as president ends.
Well, look, I think we are all very anxious to get this deal done quickly. At least I can tell you that the council president and I are very much on the same page about that. Not so much because of the timing of his presidency from my perspective, but because the time of year, the fact that we've got all these things worked out, you know, once we get out of June, then we go directly into budget, into the core of hurricane season, into the time when the Jaguars are going to have to go sell this to their ownership. So the time is really critical here. And what I think we kept trying yesterday to explain, and I think Mark did a great job with this, is that
Mark Lamping
is that there are a million parts to this agreement, and they would give some somewhere and we would give some somewhere else, and so you can't tease apart things, you know, separately without saying, well, this would affect this or this would affect that. So it, you know, to some extent, what we're trying to show the city council is our work and how we got there and why it makes sense.
But it's a little bit like a Jenga game, right?
A little bit, yeah.
I mean that seriously, though, in terms of like the city council making proposals, amendments, ideas to share, it really maybe displaces other things. It makes it harder for that deal to change in any structural way.
Well, I think that's what we were trying to say yesterday is that we can work around the edges. And that's really what you heard yesterday was not much more than working around the edges. And we'll do that. But anything that structurally changes the deal would cause us to delay probably. So at this point, I think it's a matter of trying to educate as to why we got to where we are. Frankly, I think that we are largely there on the stadium portion with the council. I think where we're having to continue to do the work is around the community benefit agreement. And that is my particular passion in all of this and where I'm trying to work very hard to get that across the finish line.
I want to talk about that. I mean, that does relate to that, obviously, is an element that there's been some pushback on council.
Yes.
Some quite vocal. And yet there was also this recent poll that was done by the University of North Florida that showed a really remarkable thing happening, I think, which is, you know, they found that the more expense that's attached to that community benefit agreement component, the more support there was. It actually had more than 80% support in Jacksonville. I can't think of a much more unifying.
It is the only thing that pushed that agreement in full into positive territory in terms of how people feel about the stadium agreement. But to me, the big deal here is that this is our opportunity to move Jacksonville off of neutral on so many places. You know, you hear people say, why can't we move downtown? Why aren't we doing better with workforce development? Why can't we solve affordable housing? This is an opportunity for us to, as I've said before, front load all of those very important issues with city money over the next 2 years, and then have the Jaguars completely continue to sustain that over a 30-year period of time. So it is the reason the community is excited about that, Ann, is because the stadium alone is not going to get us where we need to go. If we can connect the dots on these other pieces, that will truly give us the greatest opportunity for success, not only downtown, but in the competitive process of becoming the city that we want to be. And I think that is to being that city that really does work for everybody, you know?
I want to ask you, though, the pushback that has come, it has come, I think, largely from one city council member that I've seen. Rory Diamond has been really vocal on opposing this. And he's saying, look, this is $300 million, half of it from the city, half from the Jaguars. If the city didn't spend $150 million, the Jaguars would still spend $100 million on a community benefit deal. So why would we spend $150 million just to get an extra $50 million from the Jaguars?
Well, think about what you just said. We're going to leave $50 million on the table from the Jaguars and not attend to issues that are very important for our community at the same time. I'm going to say this again. You know, it is what makes this agreement so attractive to our community and why they have so roundly supported it is because we are putting our money in on the city side over the next 2 years. The Jaguars' money comes in over 30 years. There's a big difference between seeding with big money that will actually make a maximum impact for our city. We are in a situation right now where, we are competing with other cities. We are trying to move above what has been a malaise downtown for many, many years. And this would be completing those riverfront parks, investing in workforce development, investing in affordable housing and homelessness. All those things are connected, Anne. That's the thing. They're connected. And if we work on all those at once in the next 2 years and then let the Jaguars sustain, that's a much different deal. But beyond that, If the Jaguars, and they have been very clear about this, if we don't put in our $150 million, there's no guarantee of where their money's going to go. They're mostly interested in investing in the east side. So what you're very likely going to see in that situation is the Jaguars say, okay, we'll invest in the east side, which is what affects us the most. And that doesn't really have the impact on the rest of the community that we'd like to have.
Also, I mean, if it's $100 million over 30 years, that ends up being a somewhat negligible amount on an annual basis.
Well, that's what I'm saying. But it's not a negligible amount if you have invested up front in those programs and that money is coming in simply to sustain those programs. See what I'm saying?
Gotcha.
It's a very different deal. So you've heard everybody from the Civic Council to the Chamber to former Jaguar owner Wayne Weaver to a number of former mayors. You're getting ready to hear from Mayor Delaney and Mayor Payton. Same thing. Everybody that has looked at this from a business standpoint, from a leadership standpoint, has said we must do those two things together. And that is what is so critical that I hope council will see as we move through this process. We have an opportunity to be the type of city that we have said we want to be, and it's time to put our money where our mouth is.
We're talking to Mayor Donna Deegan as part of our monthly Ask the Mayor segment. We have a few calls that we want to go to. Tom, on the west side, good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning. I just wanted to ask the mayor if she believes that we have more pressing needs and higher priorities than a new jail that needs such as economic development, infrastructure, and resiliency that all seem to be things that we need to address immediately rather than pushing down the road.
Yeah, I don't. As I've often said, I think we have to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time. The jail is something that will come after the stadium, but that's why I'm saying to you when I talk about all this, it's all connected. We can't neglect one thing and say we're going to push that down the road. They're all connected things. We have to be able to create these impact moments where we can have economic development because of our investment. Any business person will tell you have to invest money to make money, right? And so at this particular time, when frankly for the development community, there are a lot of hurdles. This is a time for us to invest. I mean, if you look at what Tampa did, what actually got Tampa from being basically a deserted island on their riverfront to an absolutely thriving multi-billion dollar engine. They invested back in 2008 and 2009 when things were just, I mean, a lifetime worse than they are right now. And they said, now's the time for us to invest. And that's how I believe. I don't believe these things are disconnected. I think you have to be able to work on all those things at once. And that's why I think, to the caller's point, that's why I want to invest in all of these other things while we're still doing the big pieces.
You were actually having a social media exchange with the Tampa mayor this week, weren't you?
Yes. He has been a mentor of mine for some time. And I have been so fascinated by the success in Tampa and wanting to understand, you know, how did you make this work at a time when there was really no money anywhere? And he said, look, we made the choice that this was our competitive moment to invest in ways that perhaps, you know, on the face of it said, wow, in the middle of this economic downturn, well, yeah, this is the time to invest. It's now or never. And I think in many ways for us, we're in the same position. We can continue to sort of trickle along back and forth, or we can actually make an impact here. And this is our opportunity to do that. I don't want to leave $50 million on the table, even if it's, according to Rory, just $50 million. I don't think that's a jest. I think that's a pretty big deal in addition to all the other things we could accomplish.
We've got a call from Mark in St. Augustine. Good morning, Mark. Go ahead.
And God love you. I've got to correct you about something before I make my point. You always put the wrong spin on that study. It was less than 50% supported us giving the Jaguars $1 billion, almost $1 billion to rebuild a new stadium. It only edged up after 50% when you included the $300 million for, poor people improvement. So
that's true. Although I do think that just on its face, when they asked about the $300 million half financed by the Jaguars, that was an 81% approval by
that's
registered
correct.
Voters. But you're correct. Yeah. Without that deal, support for the stadium overall fell to 41%.
That's right. That's right. With the deal, it was up to 56%. So you're above water when you add that $300 million in. It is a huge impact. But people can see that. We've spent a lot of time educating the community about this, and now it's our work to educate the council.
Mark, I think you had a question, though, in addition to the comment.
This is completely off track, thank God. We're trying to fund a new mosh and move it down to the river, but there's something that really needs upper level hand. Everybody in Jacksonville knows that the Fort Caroline was built, the French came over, the Spanish were in St. Augustine, the French the Huguenots in Jacksonville went up, got on a ship to go attack them and get them out of here, and there's a big hurricane and their ship sank, and then they had to come back via land, and the Spanish caught them and executed them over by Matanzas Inlet. A couple of years ago, they found that ship. It was like within a swimming distance of the beach. The French government went to court and said, yeah, that's ours, and we plan to excavate it and preserve it somewhere in this area. And that was 4 years ago, and they really let the ball drop. So that would be a perfect display. I can see a diorama at the new museum. It shows all these cannons. It shows this concrete monolith. We've all seen the Temecula Indians dancing around, all those things. And it's so important to the history of Jacksonville. I don't know how you could do it, but if you could move that ball along, I think that would do a lot to really bring the history of Jacksonville to life.
Thanks, Mark. And thanks for the mini history lesson,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, no, I know. That was pretty good. I was listening. So I will certainly run that at the flagpole.
All right. We've got a call also from Wells on the south side. Good morning, Wells.
Good morning, Ann. Good morning, Mayor.
Good morning, Wells.
I want to change the subject a little bit, and I want to get your opinion on the new superintendent. School superintendent that's been chosen, and the salary he is asking for, which seems to be a little over the top. From my understanding, he is asking to get paid more than the president of the United States. And also, what are your views on the continued assault on our public school system? Thank you.
Well, look, I don't know much about that deal as it is right now. Again, I'm going to say again, because I've answered this so many times during our community huddles over the stadium.
Just to be clear, I think that the contract calls for $350,000 with some additional expense.
But my point is that the city doesn't have a role in approving that contract. That is a school board function. It is completely a separate body that decides what will happen with that contract. And frankly, all the money that comes to public schools comes through the state and federal government. So in terms of running public schools. So that doesn't have anything to do with what we're talking about with the stadium. In terms of the superintendent, I know that they have selected him. I know they are in contract negotiations. And I don't think it's uncommon for someone to ask for what they want. Doesn't mean that's exactly what's going to come down the pike. So I don't really know what to say about that. In terms of public education, I know with the debate going on about school closures, I will simply say that you know, it is a good thing to me that reality is hitting our community and hopefully in a big way of what happens when you remove 24,000 students from your traditional public schools. What happens is you have a lot of you have a lot less money coming into those public schools, and you have a lot less need for as many buildings as you have.
And by removing, you mean through things like vouchers and charter schools?
Well, that's what's happened, right? We are now offering people vouchers to go to private schools. There are people that are taking advantage of those vouchers that really could afford to send their kids to private schools because there's no limits on those vouchers. We're offering vouchers also, as you know, for charter schools, some of which are also public schools. So it is simply however you feel about that issue. It has been interesting to watch the community become educated about the fact that, yes, indeed, that is going to affect the number of public schools that we have in our city. And I would say, once again, if you do not like that, that is not a matter for the mayor. If you do not like that, I suggest that you talk to your state representatives, to your school board representatives, and to your federal representatives who fund these things and say, we don't want our public schools defunded or closed. And I think that's a very, very important thing for people to be engaged in. And I'm actually glad to see the community engagement around this issue.
And certainly there's a school board election that's coming up this fall. But to your point, a lot of those decisions are made at the state level these days in terms of financing for, you know, whether it's through vouchers or charters or anything that's an alternative to traditional public education.
They're all made at the state level. I mean, that is what has happened. And so our public schools are left with what they have. And when you have thousands and thousands of students who are now going elsewhere, there are going to be changes there. And I think people just need to understand that if we want to fund our public education, then we need to let our legislators know that's what we want.
Well, we're talking to Mayor Donna Deegan. She is taking your calls and questions. It's our monthly Ask the Mayor segment. You can reach us at 904-549-2937. You can also reach out on social media or you can email us. We have an email from David. He says, how fans in St. John's, Clay, and Nassau counties might have the opportunity to help with these stadium costs instead of it all landing on the residents' shoulders in Jacksonville. Just curious, because it seems like we subsidize a lot for the surrounding counties.
Well, listen, here's the thing. One of the things that changed tremendously in this agreement has gone from the city funding almost all of the stadium renovations or stadium maintenance and all those things to everything pretty much split. But when it comes to actually maintenance this time, a lot more is going on. What the Jaguars, there's a few dollars that are attached to each ticket as a surtax that go to, that's been going on forever, surcharge that goes to, will now all go to the maintenance of the stadium. So frankly, what the city is now spending for the maintenance of the stadium is a fraction. So what our taxpayers are now paying for the maintenance of the stadium is a fraction of what it was. So a lot in that way, those people from surrounding counties that come to the games are contributing to this agreement. But I think as we go forward, there will be other things and other ways in which our surrounding counties can become more active in that role. But I do want people to understand that this agreement is light years more fair to our taxpayers than the previous agreement was.
We've got a call from Matt in downtown. Good morning, Matt. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. As a resident of downtown, I'm wondering about the JEA towers that are now vacant. It was my understanding the JSO was thinking about moving into the old JEA tower, but now we have both JSO renting from Florida Blue over in Riverside and JEA renting a private building as well, leasing. I'm wondering if there's plans for the old JEA towers. One of them's been vacant for decades now. And what's going to happen to the newly vacated JEA and what kind of benefit is the public getting from both of these public entities leasing instead of owning buildings or using space that the city already owns?
Yeah, look, I think it's a great question. We've had a number of people that have had interest in the old JEA building. I don't know where that is at the moment in terms of that interest, but certainly in terms of the new building, it is going to be necessary to get folks in that building. I know that there are a lot of employers, including JEA, that are looking at asking more of their folks to return to the office, at least on a partial time basis, instead of being home or being elsewhere. And I think that's part of the solution. But I think the caller is correct. We have to come up with some answers for that. And I know there is a lot of interest, but I don't know where that will land at the moment.
On JEA, I mean, since we're discussing it, recently the CEO that had been chosen to lead JEA out of its crisis and scandal left without perhaps what some people feel is a full explanation as to why, or a full understanding. Do you think you have a better understanding than, say, the rest of us about what happened there?
Perhaps. I don't know. I know that I will tell you that it all came about very quickly, even for me. I personally did not know how far down the road this had gone until it was basically a done deal.
Are you worried about it?
Am I worried about it?
About the way the decision was made, or why?
Not so much. I think there were. I don't know how much I should say, Ann, honestly, because I don't know where everything is in terms of legality. But I will simply say that I believe there were some concerns from the board members in terms of how dollars were being spent and where those dollars were being spent. I know that Vicky Cavey, who is now leading that organization, has been involved with JEA for many, many years, that the board seems to have a great deal of trust in her. But at this point, what I am hearing from JEA is they have great confidence in her and the direction of the organization. But at this point, I'm going to have to let that board do its job. I don't know that there was any wrongdoing there. I don't think anybody has determined there was. But at this point, what I have been brought in on seems to make some sense to me.
And I know there's maybe things you can't discuss, as you've alluded to, but are you talking about the wisdom of spending or the legality of spending?
Oh, I don't think it's a legal issue. I don't think it's a legal issue as much as it is a fiscal issue.
Gotcha. Okay. Got a call from Michelle in Springfield. Go ahead, Michelle.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to take a step back and say thank you to Mayor Deegan for all she's done in less than a year. The stadium deal could potentially bring Jacksonville to really where it belongs. So I wanted to thank her for everything she's done in being transparent and unifying the city. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. What a nice thing to say. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Michelle. We also have a call from Evan on the West Side. Good morning, Evan. Go ahead.
Hi, Kevin.
Sorry, Kevin.
I'm concerned about these charter schools. Is it my understanding, is it correct that the charter schools have access to the public tax dollars for building maintenance?
That's right.
So I just looked at a property a month ago, public school number 57 on West Kinnett.
Uh-oh, did we lose him?
Kevin, you may have to give us a shout back because I think your call dropped. Obviously, a lot of interest in schools.
Sure.
I mean, it is a time of great change. So
it is a time of great change, and that is true. I think it is. I think it's important to point out that people and education is important. You need to educate yourself about how these funds are dispersed in charter schools. I am not making a judgment about charter schools. I'm simply saying people need to know that they also have access to those funds, and that they don't have the same types of rules around how those funds are used as our traditional public schools do.
Or in terms of academic accountability of the students.
Correct.
We've got an email from Doug. He says, I think everybody knows that the stadium cost is going to be a lot more than the estimate. And I would hope that city negotiators would have Con pony up at least half of the extra cost.
Oh.
Thank you and great job, Mayor.
Well, gosh, I'm so glad you brought that up because I thought that this was a point that we have made front and center to every one of our presentations. So I'm so glad that you said that because I'm assuming people know. The Jaguars have agreed in this contract to take on all cost overruns. Every dollar that goes over the dollars that we have committed, the $625 million that the city has committed, every dollar that comes in over that, the Jaguars have agreed to cover. So if they've even shown us a chart of cost overruns in other cities. In L.A., the cost overruns were 120% of what they said the stadium. The Jaguars, theoretically, should that happen, would cover every bit of that. So our cost is fixed. The Jaguars will cover every cost overrun that comes about.
So, but I saw kind of a subclause to that, that is if the cost overrun is due to a city-initiated delay of some kind, that the city would be responsible for those cost overruns. So I guess if there was like a permitting delay of some kind that was not, that they challenged, I mean, so there maybe is a slight exception to that.
Yeah, I think that's just a, you know, cover yourself in the event that your partner's not doing what is contractually agreed to.
But I mean, the city has occasionally not permitted in efficient way, as you well know.
Well, that is true. Although I will say that under my administration, that permitting has become much more streamlined than it was before, and we're rolling out the residential permitting process to commercial now, and we are anticipating that process is going to get even better. But I take your point. But the bottom line is, if you look at the history here, and that's been the same thing with every agreement we've had with the Jaguars. For instance, with the Miller Electric Center, that went way over budget. The Jaguars covered every single bit of that. So I think that we're covered there beyond anything that we would do to throw any sort of friction on the process.
Kevin gave a call back here. Good morning, Kevin. Let's try again.
Hi, Kevin on the West Side. And my question is regarding Public School Number 57, West Connect. It closed. It was purchased and became Waverly Academy.
Yep.
For girls. That closed. That property is now up for sale for $3.5 million. I've actually toured the property, kicking a few tires, as you will. But those roofs were redone. And as charter schools, is my understanding correct, they have access to the public dollars for maintenance?
Yes. That
is that correct?
That is correct.
So every person has a right to buy a piece of property and sell it as a profit. But I think the city needs to look into legal, and if a charter school is privately owned and they're using public dollars to re-roof or do maintenance, then that dollar amount needs to be a lien on that property so that when she sells that property, which she has a right to, I wish her the best. I hope she gets $3.5 million. But how much was paid for her to get that roof redone? I'm sure she didn't pay for it by herself. I'm sure she used public dollars. That's my tax dollars disappearing.
Kevin, that's a very interesting question.
It is. That is definitely something to look into.
Yeah. I want to ask about something you mentioned just a moment ago, because I'm curious. Obviously, Wayne Weaver came out and gave his blessing on this deal this week, which is a big deal.
In a big way. He said it was as big a deal as getting the team in the first place to be able to do this entire deal with the CBA.
But you alluded to the fact that we might also soon be hearing from former Mayor Payton, former Mayor Delaney. What?
Yes, we have received a letter from them that we are going to release shortly.
Tell us about that.
Just high praise for the entire agreement. Those are two former mayors that have certainly played their roles in moving Jacksonville forward, and they are big fans of this entire agreement. They think it can be a big game changer for the city. Much as the Better Jacksonville plan was in many ways, if we can move the ball forward on all of these things. So that should be coming out shortly. We've also received a letter from Nat Glover. There are just so many people that have been coming out of the woodwork to say to us, we want to add our voices to the chorus of folks that think this is a good idea for the community.
We had on the incoming City Council President Randy White on yesterday. Talk to him about a number of things, but I'm just curious about, you know, what your relationship is with him and how, as a mayor, you manage that relationship. Is it the kind of thing where you're taking him out to lunch? How do you get to know this person? Yeah. How do you learn if you're going to work with him?
Look, I've been intentional about trying to build relationships across the aisle over there for the entire time I've been in the office. But for all that you read publicly, and for the couple of things that we've had that have been contentious between us, I think I have a very good relationship with Ron Salem. I think what you have to remember, Ann, and you've been in the business a long time, there are folks that on both sides that really love to sort of pitch a narrative that there's discord and dissension and fighting, and sometimes there are difficult conversations, and sometimes we have different priorities. But the truth is, there's never been personal animus there. And in terms of Randy, I have a great relationship with Randy. Are we going to agree on everything over the years? Probably not. But we have a really good relationship, and already we have a very easy time discussing things. There's not ever anything personal in those discussions. And so I think in terms of just a personal, you know, rapport, it's very, very good.
Yeah. Summertime. I'm curious what you're reading, but I also know there's some literacy stuff coming up this weekend that the city is pushing.
Yes. You know, we had reset our goal from 300,000 reading minutes to 1 million. And if we haven't crossed that goal this morning, we're very, very close to crossing that 1 million minutes read goal. And we still have half the year to go. But this weekend,
remind us, is that just for kids or?
Well, basically it's for kids and it's for kids. But if your parents are reading to you, they can also log the hours.
Okay.
So it is a children's reading initiative. But what we're doing this weekend is we're at Austin Park from 9 to noon, and we'll have, dozens of kids authors that are going to be there giving out books. We're going to be giving out backpacks. The Roar will be there. Jackson DeVille will be there. We'll have all kinds of fun stuff for kids to do, face painting, all that good stuff. But the whole idea, once again, is to sort of push against the summer slide. Because what happens is a lot of times kids go home for the summer and everything goes on the shelf until they go back in the fall, and then they're sort of behind again.
Oh, yes.
So if we can make this fun, a fun activity for the summer, that's what we want to do, and break some records on that Beanstack app at the same time, get more kids engaged in this challenge.
So what's on your nightstand? I mean, when you're not mayoring and when you're not doing your run, what do you have time to read? Are you doing anything?
You know what, Ann? Honestly, I am mostly now reading ordinances and just fact sheets on things.
Awesome.
I'm reading a lot of children's books these days because I'm doing a lot of reading to kids. There's a lot of good lessons in children's books, by the way, but,
sure.
but no, I am not, my husband has become the voracious reader in the house. So basically he'll give me cliff notes, but beyond that, I haven't had a whole lot of time. I think the last book I read was the one from Sadiq Khan about, called Breathe, the mayor of London who was creating the climate initiatives in London, because I was so interested to see how he was able to clean up the air there so dramatically. But that's the last book I read, and I think that was a year ago.
Right. It's going to be a minute before you get back.
It's going to be a minute.
I just briefly wanted to ask you, this isn't under your control, but this bridge lighting question that came up, the Freedom Summer that's been declared by our governor, basically prohibits cities during Pride Month from lighting their bridges with pride colors. They have to be red, white, and blue.
Well, on bridges that are state bridges, I guess, and that would be pretty much. I thought it was really quite the initiative that the community took last weekend.
Remind us about that.
What's the book by The Obstacle is the Way? You know, that one of the Stoics. It is simply, you know, you put an obstacle there and then people find a way to make that work for them instead of against them. And I think that's exactly what our community did. They lined up with flashlights, with colored gels, and they lit the Main Street Bridge, just standing there with human power. I think there were like 70 people that were on the bridge with those flashlights. And I think
as a rainbow,
I think that's incredibly powerful. And I wish so much that this didn't continue to be such a political cudgel, because I just believe so much that we are a city that welcomes everyone and that respects everyone. And I just don't know why it's necessary. But I was very proud of the community members that did that.
Well, Mayor Deegan, thank you so much for coming on the program. We really love these monthly chats. So we'll look forward to seeing you in a month.
Thank you. Yes. Hopefully we'll have some great news to report.
All right. We'll keep an eye on it. Up next, keeping moms and babies safe from the impacts of toxic stress. Welcome back. We all experience stress in our daily lives, but when does it become a health hazard? To talk about a new effort to help expecting mothers manage and reduce toxic stress, I'm joined by Anne-Marie Knight, Vice President of Community Engagement and Chief Diversity Officer at UF Health Jacksonville. Welcome, Anne-Marie.
Good morning. Thank you.
Thanks for being here. Dr. LaRae Brown, Medical Director at UF Women's Health, who also teaches obstetrics and gynecology at the UF College of Medicine Jacksonville. Welcome, Dr. Brown.
Thank you.
And Kamala Williams, President and CEO of the Lotus Flower Project. Good morning, Kamala.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. So we all know that there are some stark health disparities when it comes to people of color in the U.S., especially Black women and children. Dr. Brown, what are the causes of this?
Yeah, so thank you for that question. Just some brief information regarding that. You know, in our nation, state, and especially in our local community, there are certain zip codes where our infant mortality rates are just through the roof. And we understand that infant health and the success of pregnancies and their outcomes are directly related to maternal health. So we really have dived deeply to kind of understand that. And it's complex, but at the root of it, we do acknowledge that chronic toxic stress can play a huge role.
And explain what toxic stress is, in as opposed to just the stress like I missed the bus or my homework's overdue.
Excellent question. So if you put stress into three buckets, there is positive stress, and that's, you know, the stress we have each morning when we're trying to rush out of the house and get to work or get to school. Then there's tolerable stress. So, you know, an impact of a death in the family. So you can get through that with support, but it doesn't necessarily cause lifelong effects. Then there's chronic toxic stress, which is just unrelenting chronic issues associated with an impact to the physiologic state of your body. So it ranges from stress related to socioeconomic status, racial discrimination, healthcare disparities.
Okay. And what do we know about how that impacts a mother or an expectant mother, particularly, you know, with a child in utero?
Yeah, good question. So if you imagine that chronic toxic stress creates a chronic fight or flight syndrome, that definitely changes the way our body processes stress in our interaction with having a healthy life. So those impacts can directly affect your cardiovascular system, where it raises your blood pressure and in turn changes the way your heart function. It can change your ability to fight off infection. So chronic wear and tear on your body can lead to those physiologic changes. And then during pregnancy, one of the most vulnerable times in a woman's life, we can see those harmful effects, thereby impairing maternal health and directly affecting our babies.
Anne-Marie Knight, what do we know at this point about how Duval County's infant mortality rate compares to the rest of the country, the rest of the state, the rest of the world?
Right. So if you were to go out to our Florida health charts, you would see that there's a significant gap between African-American and other women across our community. Our gap is increasing, unfortunately. For example, when we look at 2020, the gap between infant mortality was 7.95, and now we're slightly increasing to 8.35. So while we have made great strides in our city, across our city.
That number represents per 1,000?
Per 100,000.
Per 100,000. So explain to us what those two numbers mean and how those compare to people who are not women of color.
So what that represents is per 100,000 women, 7.95 in that example, children or infants were lost over that period of time. So it's a statistical way to level set the data across all data points across the nation and across Florida. So what it means to us is we focus on, you know, doing the work and engagement to reduce infant mortality of each race group, but then we also have to pay attention to the gap between the groups. So the gap is very significant for African Americans versus Caucasians.
So you're saying that overall the rate is almost 8, and for African American women, it's more than that.
So let me give you the example of 2020. 12.75 for African American.
So nearly 13 children per 100,000?
Right. In Duval County. For Caucasian women, 4.8.
Okay.
So that's the gap of 7.95.
Gotcha. So the difference between five children, almost five children dying
To 13.
To 13. So that's really significant.
That is really significant.
And so the understanding is that toxic stress is one of the contributors. Is it the main contributor to that disparity?
No, as Dr. Brown has alluded, there's other factors, right? So this is talking about infant mortality, and then the toxic stress of the mom impacts the maternal experience. So there's, of course, health access would be an issue. There's impoverished communities. What access resources do they have across the community? And for our particular work that we're focused on today around toxic stress, what's happening in the mother's world that she can control or respond to help reduce infant mortality in her time?
Kamala, the work that you do at Lotus Flower Project helps women who are experiencing high levels of stress and offer some programs. What kind of things help alleviate that stress?
So we've connected with U of Health in fostering community. One, so that women know that they're not alone and that stress isn't taboo. And so we bring them together to talk about that stress and to educate them on ways to reduce that stress and then give them some tangible resources that helps alleviate that natural stress that women have every day about things like diaper needs, toilet paper, paper towel, laundry detergent, clothing, baby clothes. Those things women often stress about, we provide those tangible resources for them after that education piece. So community building so that you know you're not alone, and then some tangible resources to walk away with to help alleviate some of that that stress. And then also outsourcing other deeper rooted stress like grief. So offering coping sessions and workshops to deal with grief, the loss of a child, the loss of a loved one, the loss of a job, the loss of a lifestyle. We know that grief is not just the loss or burial of a person, but it's the loss of many things. And so offering those coping classes and workshops as well as the community.
And as well as the actual items if they're in need.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're talking about the impact of toxic stress on expecting mothers and their babies. You can join our conversation live on air by calling 904-549-2937. You can also email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org or reach out on social media. We're going to have to take a short break. We'll be back in just a minute with more.
Congarean Pen, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering field-to-fork dining and outdoor experiences on over 300 acres. Sip, dine, explore. Information at congareeandpen.com.
North Florida TPO, proud sponsor of WJCT's First Coast Connect, bringing to the community innovation in transportation planning, commuter services, clean fuels, and intelligent transportation systems. More at northfloridatpo.com.
On the next Florida Roundup, climate change on your TV weather forecast, heat advisories, a more active than normal storm season. Some local TV meteorologists are weaving climate change reporting into their regular weather forecasts. State agencies no longer have to consider climate change under a new law. How do you feel about climate change comments creeping into your weather forecast? Email us radio@thefloridaroundup.org. I'm Tom Hudson. Then join us Friday at noon.
$640 million Indians went to the polls to vote, and the results are in. Many voters sent a message to India's authoritarian leader, Narendra Modi. We're over it.
maybe they're not kicking Modi out of power, but they are sending an unmistakable message to the BJP that you can't do whatever you want.
How Indians clawed back their democracy, coming up on Today Explained.
Tonight at 6:30 here on WJCT News 89.9.
Thursday marks the 80th anniversary of D-Day, when over 150,000 Allied troops landed on the beaches of Normandy. Tomorrow, we speak with historian and author Garrett Graff about his new book that spotlights some of that day's heroes.
My uncle, Richard C. Andrews, delivered troops and took wounded back to ships on D-Day in Normandy.
What D-Day was like for the people who lived it. Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. We're talking about the stress impacts that affect maternal health, that affect outcomes for infants. And you can join our conversation if you want to give us a call at 904-549-2937. You can also reach out on social media or email us. Dr. Brown, the issue of toxic stress, it isn't something you've just seen in patients. It is something that you personally have experienced. Talk about your own lived experience.
Yeah, thank you. So I am not only a full-time OBGYN, but my most important job is to be a mom. And I do have, me and my husband have six children. Right. So as you can imagine, I've had a myriad of experience and interaction with healthcare, and both the environment that I have lived has definitely created an interesting conundrum. So I'll just briefly talk about my last delivery. So I have a two-year-old daughter now. So I am juggling full-time job, raising five children, full-time wife, daughter, aunt, sister-in-law and sister, on top of a very stressful career and profession. And then all of the things that are surrounding us in our nation, in our world. And that's a very important concept for us to realize, that even people who seemingly have access to lots of resources or seemingly have access to excellent access to healthcare, there are still certain factors within our culture, within our society, that can predispose us to poor health outcomes, or at least put us at risk for those. So identifying that, like Kamala mentioned, the awareness, the education surrounding that can definitely be helpful. So for my example, I have access to care. My physicians are my best friends. You know, I work and live in the hospital, essentially. I have prior knowledge. I have access to food, education, medication. But even with my last delivery, there were some moments during my hospitalization where my husband was very concerned about the possibility of me making it home. And it's not directly related to how much I exercise or how great I ate, or my access and the equity that I was able to achieve, you know, being in my specific position. But a lifetime of chronic stressors, a lifetime of just being a Black woman in America could have predisposed me to, you know, differences in that. And we see that in the data. You know, a Black woman with a college education has the same mortality rate as a uneducated, no high school degree white woman in our country. So there's a lot of underlying things that we are still figuring out and learning together. So education and awareness is just the first step.
And Kamala, in the work that you do, you have received feedback from people who have been gratified for the lessons that they learned. Even people who represented themselves as a good advocate for themselves in the healthcare system found that they were really in a serious way, in an effective way, empowered by the what they learned from going through some of the education.
Yes. Recently, we received what we call a testimony from a participant who participated in our program and basically said that, you know, she was there not thinking that she needed that education because she advocates for herself often, you know, and that she's a good advocate for herself. And because she participated, she received the free blood pressure cuffs that we provide and weight scales that we provide. And she wasn't feeling well. She's pregnant, wasn't feeling well, went to a doctor, and they didn't run any, you know, tests. And so she kept monitoring her blood pressure with the monitor that she received at our program. And it kept rising and kept rising. And after another visit to the doctor, she learned that, you know, she was at risk. And it was because of that education that she received, because we talk about getting a second opinion. We talk about asking questions. We talk about not allowing doctors to just dismiss how you're feeling. We talk about, yes, every pregnancy is different, but you still can ask questions. And because she advocated for herself, she saw and got a second opinion, the guidance that we gave and the discussions that we're having saved her life.
Because her initial response that she got was, you should just drink some more water.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And Anne-Marie, this program is part of, you know, a community-wide effort that is addressing the issues of toxic stress, maternal health, infant mortality,
that's right,
writ large.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I see you had the mayor here earlier. She specifically has this as one of her platforms and areas of interest. There's Northeast Florida Healthy Start Coalition, who Faye Johnson is a leader in this work. So we're just part of the team. We've come together with our assets, with our resources and support, and said we want to participate. We want to go upstream and engage with women preconception and just talk with them, sit with them, provide resources, and help them in their journey and their understanding of how stress will impact their body.
And so you're talking to women who aren't pregnant, even people who are thinking
Absolutely.
That they're going to get pregnant.
Absolutely.
And that's a time for intervention even that at that point.
Absolutely. Preparation is key.
Yeah.
It's not simply about that prenatal experience when you're pregnant and making sure you have certain resources. It's also prior to even that decision of becoming pregnant.
So if someone is thinking about becoming pregnant or they are pregnant, where can they go to find information?
Sure. So they could contact us. We can be reached at 904-244-8415. The UF Health Jacksonville website, Urban Health Alliance, has our Life's Course program there. The email address is uha@jax.ufl.edu as an education.
Anne-Marie Knight, Dr. Larae Brown, Kamala Williams, thank you so much for being here this morning.
Thank you for having me.
We appreciate it.
And that's our program. Join us Friday when our media roundtable talks about everything from the politics of stadium financing to questions surrounding Duval County's next superintendent. I'm Ann Schindler. You've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.